This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkar, and more importantly, I have the pleasure and indeed honor today of inviting to the podcast Dr. Asko Parpola, who is Professor Emeritus of Indology and South Asian Studies at the University of Helsinki. Asko, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, for those of us who are in South Asian Studies or Indology, he'll be a name known to us because he's been producing scholarship in the area for some time. Before we talk about the particular contributions, Asko, would you tell us a bit about the genesis, the backstory? How did you get involved in this field? Tell us.
Well, I came to the university to study classics. That means Latin and Greek, ancient Greek. I had long Latin in school, so... But at that time, for master's degree, one was required to have three subjects. So I just looked at the university catalog, what else is there offered. And then I discovered that there's a subject called Sanskrit and comparative linguistics. Well, I joined the introductory course in Sanskrit and almost immediately found that this is my field.
You fell in love.
Yes. And well, when I got to the PhD phase, my professor gave me as topic continuing the work of one of his predecessors, Dr. Reuter, who had started editing Drahyayana Shrauta Sutra, a Samaved, which belongs to the Samaveda. He had published 1/5 of this text with Tanvin's commentary. The rest of the text remained unpublished, but he had completed it. It was accessible to me in the university library. And for my PhD, I translated this published part. That means the first two chapters of the Latyayana Shrauta Sutra, which is almost identical with Drahyayana. My intention was to compare these two texts, Drahyayana Shrauta Sutra and Latyayana Shrauta Sutra, because they throw interesting light in how many Vedic texts have come into being. I mean, they are based on previously existing work. And, well, my thesis was a sort of introduction comparing these two texts. But in addition, I translated into English the first chapters dealing with the Agnistoma, which is the simplest form of soma sacrifice, giving advice to Sama Vedic priests what they have to do when they participate in such a ritual. Please go on. Yeah.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the Indus Valley culture and script, and maybe contextualize a little bit what the issue is with the script.
Well, perhaps we could come to this a little bit later, because I would like. I mean, you invited me because of, I think, the recent publications which
are absolutely
disseminated. So I just wanted to continue that while doing this work on the Latiyayana and Rahyayana, I discovered that these two Sama Vedic schools, Kautuma and Ranayaniya school, to which these two texts belong, they have most texts in common. I mean, only on the Shraudha Sutra level and Griha Sutra level, they are separate texts. But it seemed to me that the text that they had in common actually marked their school attachment through the terms used for chapters and the way they divide the texts. And I wanted to check whether this actually was true of the manuscripts also, not because we cannot be sure that the editors have not messed with the terms, colophons and so on. So I was going through manuscript catalogues, especially such which give quotations from the manuscripts. And in the catalogue of the Tanjore Maharaja Serfoji's manuscript library, I discovered one text which had been said to be Mashakaskalpa Sutra, a published text of Kautuma Samaveda. But I discovered that it cannot be this text, because the quotation gave Jaiminiya names of rituals in the order in which they are in Jaiminiya Brahmana. Jaiminiya is the other main school of Samaveda. We have Kautuma Samaveda with Ranayaniya sub-school and Jaiminiya. Now, from Jaiminiya Samaveda, very few texts were known. One was this Jaimini Shraudha Sutra, but it is a very short text, only of the same length as that part which I had translated. So I ordered a microfilm of this manuscript, but the library was unable to microfilm manuscripts, so I got eventually a Devanagari transcript. I did myself photograph it several times later on, but indeed it could be seen that this is a previously unknown Vedic text. And this was in 1966, long time ago. And by a coincidence, a commentary on this text appeared in the same year, but without the actual sutra. The commentator only quoted the first two and two last syllables of the sutras that he was commenting. This was published by Prem Nidhi Shastri in Delhi with the title Bhavatratas Jaimini Shrauta Sutra Vritti. Now, the first part was really Jaimini Shrauta Sutra, the published text. But the major part of this commentary was a commentary on the text that I had just discovered. But that commentary published in Delhi was based on one single manuscript. And the text was not correct. So almost on every line, you had mistakes. And it was difficult to understand without the basic text. So I decided that more manuscripts are needed of both the text and commentary. And this was my task, to find them in India.
Not an easy task.
No, actually. But on my very first trip to India, yes, Pakistan and India in 1971, I started this search for manuscripts. And it has been continued ever since, every now and then, together with my former student, Professor Masato Fuji from Kyoto. We have made regular expeditions and really combed South India, especially Kerala and Tamil Nadu. Private scholars, private Jaiminiya scholars, asking for their relatives, I mean, addresses of their relatives, and also all the manuscript libraries over there, and also in North India and elsewhere. So to come to the result of all this, 14 manuscripts of the commentary were traced. Actually, they could be reduced by to four originals, because the rest are copies from these, copies or copies. And of the basic texts, no new manuscripts. So those that I had discovered were quite unique.
Fascinating.
But getting new manuscripts was not the only hurdle in publishing these texts, because they are dealing with the Samans of the Jaiminiya Sakha, Jaiminiya school. And these have not been published at that, had not been published at that time, only afterwards. So we could know, I mean, I could get even manuscripts of these earlier Samavedic texts, unpublished texts, so that I could start preparing the commentary, the edition of these texts and their commentaries.
Fascinating. Now, the listener might be aware from the podcast notes that this extensive work, this work on editions of the Jaiminiya Samaveda Sutras, are available. They're now available. They've been digitized, and they're available through the links in the podcast notes. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that process, or what prompted you to create this amazing resource for us?
Well, that is actually a preliminary edition, because I think I have fairly well established the text. I mean, it's in very good Sanskrit, and I could understand the commentary for almost everything. I mean, there just a few places were left, you know, uncertain. But I wanted to, you know, publish a preliminary edition because I'm getting old. I'm having a serious illness. So I wanted at least a preliminary edition be available for scholars. I want to complete that edition later on because I have also several other projects to complete. You mentioned the Indus Valley thing. I mean, this was also, this is a long time project.
Tell us about it.
Well, for my Greek studies at the university, we could study some special book. And I had chosen the decipherment of Linear B, which was a sensation in the early 1950s, just about 10 years before I started my university studies. And there was a comparable problem in India, the Indus Valley script, which has not been deciphered. So together with my brother, Simo Parpola, who is an Assyriologist, he was also a student at that time, we thought that we might be able to do something also by using computers, something that had become available at that time. We also had a good childhood friend who was working for the IBM and who was willing to do the computer programming for us. So we transcribed the Indus texts into numbers and feeded them to the computer, to which then gave us lists, I mean, which could be used in analyzing the structure of the inscriptions. And we also contemplated how, by which methods this script could be deciphered. In 1969, I got my first job in Copenhagen. And there, besides other work, I published the first preliminary results of our work in the name of the whole team. There were some important breakthroughs, which I think will hold good. But unfortunately, in the enthusiasm, I also published some very unripe ideas and with too sure tone. So those first announcements met very heavy criticism, which was very useful, but not so encouraging. But fortunately, there were also some expert like John Chadwick, who helped Michael Ventris in the decipherment of Linear B, who were positive. So I continued this work I mean, getting rid of the defects of the first announcement and going further with the research. And in 1994, I published a book, Deciphering the Indus Script, in which I made proposed readings for about 20 Indus signs. So not for the entire script, which I think is impossible at this time with the materials that are available to us. We must remember that the cuneiform script could be really deciphered almost entirely by means of dictionaries prepared by the ancients. So we don't have even any sort of translation into a known language or known script of these Indus texts. And actually, even if such a translation would become available, it would only apply to the limited amount of text that would be included in that translation. But for any decipherment, it is important to get hold of all material, all available material, and in such a good shape as, I mean, in the best possible shape available. So I started also a photographic corpus of Indus seals and inscriptions. The Congress of Orientalists in 1973 gave its support to this project, and I could get some nominal UNESCO funding, just a few thousand dollars, for the project to be completed in collaboration with Pakistan and India. So far, four big volumes have come out, and I'm working on the last volume.
Exciting. Well, certainly when that volume emerges, we'll have to have you back to cover it and talk a little bit more in depth about the project. So you mentioned that you have a number of projects on the go. Certainly you're still looking at the sutras, and apparently you're still actively working on the Indus Valley script. Yes. Is there anything else that's, not that this isn't sufficient, this would be more than enough for we mortals, but is there anything else that you're looking at?
Well, I have a third project trying to find out the archaeological background of the Indo-Aryans coming to India.
The coming of the Aryans.
Yes, correct. So I became interested in archaeology because of the Indus Valley. Naturally, I have been interested not only in the script, but also the context, that means the Indus civilization in general and its background and aftermath in South Asia. But there's also the question when and from where the Aryans came to India. I mean, this is a very hot issue, of course, politically, even today. But I have been making proposals, you know, from time to time, and learning also about the archaeology of Central Asia and Russia and Eastern Europe. And actually, this has been, a topic which has interested also Indo-Europeanists. Jim Mallory wrote a very pioneering book, In Search of the Indo-Europeans, in 1989. At that time, there was a question, was the Indo-European motherland in Anatolia, or was it in the East European steppes? Mallory developed a method. He was taking each Indo-European language and following it to its roots. I mean, how far can you go back and where does it get you? I mean, which area? And what archaeological cultures are involved? And then could all these midway cultures be derived from a single archaeological culture? So this book, actually, his proposals have been proved right by the great development of genetic research. About 2015 and onwards, we have publications based on DNA taken from ancient bodies, where we know the archaeological context. And it has been shown that people from the steppes north of the Black Sea have spread both to Asia, to Siberia, and to Europe from this area, changing the population very drastically, especially in parts of Europe. So the spread of Indo-European from the north of Black Sea has become a reality. Now, as regards to the Aryan branch, an important discovery was made in southern Siberia, close to the Ural Mountains, in 1970s. So-called Sintashta culture was discovered with horse-drawn chariots buried together with the people. Now, we know that the Rig Vedic Aryans are referring to horse-drawn chariots all the time. Such chariots are not found in the Indo civilization. Not even horse has been found. There are claims of horse bones, but these are very probably from the wild asses, which are native to the salt ranges of Gujarat and Pakistan. So these Sintashta chariots are chronologically the first anywhere in the world, according to our present knowledge. And both the Indo-Aryan and Iranian languages have terms suiting this, so we can reconstruct the terms for chariots for the Proto-Aryan language. So apparently the Sintasta culture is the from where the Indo-Aryans came. Of course, not directly, but we can follow in archaeology the progress. They came to South Asia in the around the middle of the second millennium BC.
Fascinating. So before we close today, let me just, we'll pan out to a broad question. Clearly you have a number of aims, a number of interests, and clearly you've been working in Indology for some decades. What, looking back, what are some of the, what do you notice about the field, about trends in scholarship, or perhaps perhaps what is your hope? You know, what can you sort of share from your bird's eye perspective about avenues perhaps you hope that would be taken up, or perhaps trends you've noticed in Indology over the decades?
Well, I mentioned that I discovered two unknown texts, previously unknown texts, in one library in India. Now, it is supposed that there exist some, at least some 10 million manuscripts, and it may be possible to make similar discoveries of totally unknown Sanskrit texts, also texts in other Indian languages. I'm just reminding that one of the most important Sanskrit texts, I mean, from many angles, is the Arthashastra of Kautilya, which was unknown before about 1905, when the first manuscript, the only manuscript of this text, became known. So there may lie still, you know, similar discoveries in the manuscript libraries.
Diamonds in the rough.
Yes. Yes. So I think going through the manuscripts, and many of them are accessible in well-described manuscripts, but not all manuscripts have been well-described. Only title has been given, and maybe that title is wrong. I mean, it depends on the cataloger. So there's a lot of work in that field, which may lead to interesting discoveries. So this is one thing. Well, I must say that I enjoyed the best time of my life in Kerala. Not only studying Samaveda with the ancient, with the old masters, I mean the last generation who had the traditional training, they are now away. But I also discovered that the Keralan culture is so rich in folklore traditions. I mean, here in the West, we know Kathakali, Koodiyattam, but not Teyyam. I mean, these are names that Indologists and others know from the Keralan folklore background. Of course, not only folklore, but also Sanskrit literature and so on. But there's a catalogue of Keralan folklore, and it lists more than 100 folk arts. Of these, what I mentioned are just three. So it's an exciting field. I actually took I discovered one statue which had actually been identified as Yama in the Trichur Museum, but which actually depicted the unknown cult, a god of sorcery in Kerala, Kuttichaattan. Very little was known about this god in the handbooks that I, on iconography or otherwise. So I took 1 month off and just chased Kuttichaattan cult for 1 month, very, very intensively. And actually, I have a big book. I had a good photographer with me. And publishing this book is one of the tasks that I still have ahead of me. But I did publish a very condensed summary in 1998, I think. It was called, I mean, in a book called Aryan and Non-Aryan in India.
Fascinating. Well, certainly whenever you publish a book, I know a guy who runs a podcast who would happily have you back on to share the fruits of your labor with the broader community and interested public. It's great that you, after all these decades, you haven't lost your passion. I think we're passionate about these things. Why else would anybody in the right mind study these things other than just sheer interest? But it's so refreshing that you haven't lost your sense of discovery and wonder at the newness of it. You know, not the passion for the known paths or the great amount that we know about and need to clarify about ancient India, but seemingly on the cusp of the unknown, this sort of entrepreneurial consciousness where, you know, what's in these manuscripts, you know, how do we better decipher Indus Valley script if we ever can, you know, how, you know, you seem to have this consciousness of exploration that's very much alive. It's very refreshing. So thank you for appearing on the podcast today. For those listening, we have, of course, been speaking with Dr. Asko Parpola, who is Professor Emeritus of Indology and South Asian Studies at the University of Helsinki. Keep well until next time. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating what might be out there to discover in a pile of manuscripts or in material culture. Take care.